Charles Corey. May it please the Court, Your Honor. There's the primary issue. Well, there are two big issues in this case. Number one, was it reasonable? Was there equitable tolling? Another issue that's near and dear to my heart is Raspberry. And Raspberry, this Court doesn't have to get to Raspberry, but I wish you would, because you can decide this case and reverse it on the basis that what Christopher Smith had to deal with in his declaration, and the Court, I'm sure, is familiar with that very short handwritten declaration that he gave to the district court at the outset of this case, saying why he desperately needed a stay. And he named a gang, and I can tell the Court that if you were to call, and I asked the Court to take judicial notice of this gang. If I called the litigation office and Richard Donovan, asked him, the litigation coordinator, absolutely, yeah, they're all, it's the protective custody gang. And they do just exactly what Christopher Smith said. They pick on undersized people, sex offenders, mentally retarded. I heard another case of mental retardation. They pick on them. They take their canteen. They beat them up. And they terrorize them. And as I said in my briefs, I use the Internet. There is an enormous amount on the Internet about how sex offenders are brutalized in prison.
Did those facts keep Mr. Smith from timely filing petitions or appeals in the state court?
Except for 25 days of a period of time. And I've got to talk about this.
No, these are not rhetorical questions.
He was able to do it up to a point. Up to a point. It gets different when you go up to the Supreme Court. You have to have more copies. You try to do more. He had help from his parents.
No, but part of the meaning of my question is, you're arguing that he was essentially disabled from filing in a timely way in federal court, and the record suggests that he was, in the same circumstances, able to timely file, usually almost always, in the state court. I'm trying to initially determine if that's a factually accurate perception for me to have.
Well, he actually filed in federal court. Okay, to answer your question, he barely made it 45 days before that time. That's using up a lot of time.
In state court?
In federal court. But in state court, he was late. He was very late.
Well, the California system is a bit bizarre because there are no time limits between, and there's not even necessarily a progression. I mean, you could start in the Supreme Court and then go to the Superior Court and then go to the Court of Appeal, and there are no time limits that are set forth. We have cases that say this period of time is reasonable, that period of time isn't reasonable. But those time periods are to me, related to the circumstances of those cases. And we still don't have a bright-line rule of what is the time limit between each stage of the proceedings and whether there is a correct way to proceed in the state court. I wish the legislature would act here.
I'm petrified as a 2254 attorney every time I get one of these cases because I never know whether my filings are going to be held timely by the state court. And so I ask for stay and obey in every single one of my cases. In Massachusetts, I know you don't have that problem. California, Judge Wardlaw said it. Bizarre. It is bizarre. And it's a tremendous burden. And it is confusion. It's more than confusion.
Let me ask, in your state habeas proceeding, did you file state habeas proceedings?
I didn't have any. I didn't get in on this.
He filed
pro se before he went to federal court. He started up the ladder.
Was it a habeas? Was any one of those denied expressly for untimeliness?
not.
So he had not a single denial for entitlement.
Not a one, but he didn't know that, and he didn't know. He couldn't predict what was going to happen. No practitioner, much less a pro se, can ever predict what a state court is going to do.
Well, so what do we make of the fact that no state court denied his habeas on the grounds of untimeliness?
I think that's very powerful in that it's not right to a federal judge to then say you're untimely, even though the state court never found you untimely. We're going to find you untimely because you're 25 days late from over a 60-day arbitrary limit. 60 days. That came out of the air. I'm sorry.
May I ask you a few more factual questions? It appears that the first petition, which may or may not be before us, but these are intertwined, did not have any exhausted claims.
Exactly. Correct.
And then the judge offered 60 days to amend, and there was a motion to stay denied, and then a motion to amend was filed December 30th. It was set to be on time, but did the motion to amend that was filed December 30 include any exhausted claims?
No.
Because my reading of the record is there were some claims that were exhausted, but they weren't presented to the federal court. So you're faced, at that point, I think, with Rhine, and it's not a mixed petition. I just wanted to...
You're right.
Then you do get to the point you really want to make. Can you talk to us about what's wrong with Raspberry, and if this court has the discretion, should the Third Circuit decision in Helleva be limited to the facts or Pace, or is it more expansive?
Raspberry doesn't mention Pace, and Pace does have an exception. If I'm not wrong, it talks about Rhines. Now, they came down in the same volume, but Pace came down after. And my opponent pointed out very clearly in his response brief, yes, there is an exception, and it's in Pace, and that's the exception of confusion. Well, Judge Wardlaw just pointed out confusion is implicit in the bizarre situation. You have to be confused as a practitioner and more so as a pro se when you're going up the ladder. So what I'm saying is I don't think you have to overrule Raspberry. That's a big thing to ask you to do, and I didn't ask you to do it.
Counsel, our three-judge, if I could interject a question and comment, our three-judge panel cannot overrule Raspberry. A panel of the court can't overrule another panel. So we could distinguish it or have a different path to decision, but only an en banc court on the Ninth Circuit can overrule Raspberry as far as the court goes.
Absolutely.
I have this question to you on confusion. When your client made his first federal habeas petition, or rather his first request for stay to the federal court, did he allege confusion on the state timeline?
He alleged...
I didn't notice that.
He didn't use the word. He said fear, and not having my transcripts, and fear of being outed. Fear of being outed. He had successfully hidden his sex offender status. And you can do that in prison. You can successfully hide it. And he did. And he had to continue it. Your Honor, my clients don't even want me, when I have sex offenders, to send the briefs to them. They don't want anybody to see those briefs. So I don't see the difference between fear of being beaten up and maybe even worse, and confusion. I think confusion, like Judge Wardlaw said, is implicit. And in every California case, there is confusion, and you don't have to say it, and a pro se doesn't have to say it. He said what was on his mind. He couldn't have the transcripts. He was delayed. And I've got to get back to this 60-day thing that's hanging us up. It came from Evans versus Chavis. The facts of that case are incredible. If you read them, it's not a 6-month delay, it's a 3-year delay.
But it also says that's a presumption. So it's,
yeah,
it's
but
a,
they,
a presumption, and then you have to examine the circumstances between each.
That's right.
To see whether it's reasonable.
The Supreme Court in Evans versus Chavis was faced with 3 years, and they whittled it down. They gave him credit for not being able to go to the law library. It's in the case. And they whittled it down to 6 months, and they said, sorry, we can't cut it down any further than that. Yes, you were jerked around in prison. You couldn't go to the law library. But they whittled it down to 6 months and said, sorry, and we're going to set arbitrarily 30 to 60 days, just, you know, right out of the air. There is nothing else. There is no Ninth Circuit case, by the way. I looked everywhere. There is no Ninth Circuit case that says that a delay of this short is going to put you out of court. None. None. I have to tell you that in the excerpt of record, you're going to see where the district court judge had all these cases, district court cases. Every single one of those cases, I challenge anybody to read those cases and say what the district court judge said they said. There's 3 years. There's huge amounts of time. I'm sorry. The research attorney for Judge Burns did a bad job.
Okay. You're over your time.
Uh-oh. Thank you. 136
I'll give you a minute
to go.
For rebuttal.
I think 136 over.
I'm 136 over. So
yes.
Can I have a minute to respond?
Yes, you may.
Thank you.
You may.
You don't read that very well.
Yes, I know. It confuses people.
May it please the Court. Good morning. I'm Kevin Viena, California Deputy Attorney General for Respondent Appellee in this matter. I'd like to begin by focusing on one question was asked or suggested, and that is which district court judgment is the subject of this appeal? At least I think that's the question. Much of the briefing and much of the focus for Mr. Khoury in this case is his argument that the stay was improperly denied in the first district court case. That matter was not appealed, not timely appealed, and I think that is not an issue that's before this court for decision.
That is problematic with this case, that a notice of appeal was not filed.
Well, not for me, perhaps.
No, I'm sorry, I said for his case.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And forgive my weak attempt at humor there.
Oh. Right. Happens to all of us.
So the question then is, really, the appeal in this case is whether the district court properly dismissed the second federal petition as untimely. And it's not disputed, I think, the key dates are not disputed. That is, there was a 320-day period of time following finality of the state court judgment during which the statute of limitations ran. And then while Mr. Smith was exhausting his state court remedies, there was a period of 85 days between between the denial of his petition in the California Court of Appeal and the filing of his petition in the California Supreme Court.
Counsel, Judge Gould, if I could interject a question and try to cut to the chase here. If we were to say that the 85-day gap was reasonable and so that his California State Supreme Court petition was not untimely, then that wouldn't, just for argument, if we said that, then that would mean his federal second habeas petition would be timely because you wouldn't count that 85 days, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. In that case, there would have been only 320 days that expired on the statute of limitations.
Okay, so trying to cut to the chase here, for me, the key issue is, you know, what precedent is there on one side or the other that would say whether 85 days can be a reasonable period for that gap? My understanding is the California Supreme Court, of course, didn't say the basis for its denial, right?
Correct, Your Honor. It was a summary denial.
So they might have denied on the merits, or they might have denied as untimely. But from our perspective, what precedent is there that bears on whether the 85 days is reasonable?
They're not in the material.
Yes, isn't there a case that when the California Supreme Court is denying, you're an attorney general, so I'm asking you this. Isn't there a case that when the California Supreme Court is denying a petition as untimely, that it routinely cites?
Yes, there is, Your Honor.
What is that case?
In re Robbins, or occasionally in re Clark and Robbins.
Right, and that's how we know that it was denied as untimely.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's the information on which we would act. That is, right. If there's a Robbins denial, we would say there's no tolling for any of that period.
Right. So, but in this case, I understand there was no citation to Robbins or
precisely
Clark. Okay.
Once again, I agree that if Mr. Smith were entitled to 85 days of equitable tolling for the interval between the Court of Appeal petition and his California Supreme Court petition, he would be timely.
Be statutory tolling as opposed to equitable tolling?
I don't see that there's a way for statutory tolling. Well, that is statutory tolling. Yes, I agree. That is statutory tolling under Evans versus Chavis, or before that, Carey versus Saffold, examining the California system of original habeas corpus petitions and accommodating that to Section 2244 statute of limitations, if a petitioner proceeds in a reasonable period of time, 30 to 60 days between the state court, then he's entitled to tolling, even though there is technically no petition pending in any state court at that point.
I had understood the petitioner's brief to focus a good amount on Raspberry and how it was criticized in the Third Circuit decision, Helleva, which has interpreted Pace to provide more discretion than Raspberry, which didn't cite Pace, suggested. How, if we were in the Third Circuit, would it be permissible, if not required, but permissible to find that this petition was timely filed under that Helleva case?
Perhaps under Helleva, but I think not under Pace. And because what's missing was in the first federal habeas petition, what was missing was a demonstration that Mr. Smith was reasonably confused about the timeliness of filing in the state courts. And Ryan says that stays are permissible in limited circumstances. Pace seems to me to be an example, a specific example of Ryan's, that is, when there's good cause, but in limited circumstances.
I think the Third Circuit said in Helleva, while confusion was the issue in that case, there might be something other than confusion.
I think what I would say is that there'd have to be, at a minimum, confusion, but there'd also have to be some reason, perhaps, for starting late. That is, if your argument is, I'm not sure I can get this done in the time remaining in the federal statute of limitations, there should also be some examination about whether there was good cause that prevented earlier filing in the state court.
And then prevented earlier filing in the state court. And what about the petitioner's argument that he was inhibited in his filings, delayed in his filings because of fear that he'd be found out to be a sex offender and punished?
I certainly don't think that is a negligible concern. I think, however, that Mr. Smith has failed to show the proper nexus between his fear and the delay, and in particular, the 85-day delay between his Court of Appeal petition and the California Supreme Court petition, because there was nothing to change. He was recycling a petition, and he didn't need any additional materials, and he had shown that he'd had the time to get that done by commencing in the state courts.
I find it telling that Judge Burns found this issue sufficiently thorny that he issued a COA. Usually we don't see the district court issuing a COA after they make this kind of a finding. It's usually the Ninth Circuit that will make the COA.
My comment on that, Your Honor, and it's bad psychology perhaps, but a COA can be issued by a district court judge if he thinks if the issue is worthy of further development. And that might be his concern. That is, he may have been concerned about whether the denial of the stay was lawful or whether Raspberry should be adjusted. I disagree about whether this court can and should reach that question. But I think that is an issue that is worthy of further development and eventually will have to be addressed by this court.
Counsel, doesn't that issue relate, though, to the first federal habeas?
Yes, only
petition dismissal, which wasn't appealed. So we really can't get at that issue unless we did it indirectly on an issue of whether a mistake on that, you know, gives grounds for tolling or equitable tolling or something on the second federal habeas petition.
I agree completely, Your Honor, and what I would say is that it doesn't create a basis for equitable tolling. A mistake in a district court might, if a district court misleads some petitioner in a way that prevents him from filing eventually timely filing. But in this case, that if there was a mistake, and it's not clear at all that there was in the first one, in fact, we think they were bound by Raspberry, but if that was a mistake, that didn't affect what Mr. Smith was doing in the state courts. It simply was a matter of no consequence.
Why is it that we shouldn't reach the Raspberry question?
Because that is a direct challenge to the judgment in the first federal habeas corpus matter, Your Honor. I'm at 18 seconds, I believe I've covered. Oh, I do have one other point. My adversary suggests that I think he makes two arguments that can't prevail. One is that the confusion in California means that every petitioner is entitled to a stay in every case. That can't be consistent with the limited circumstances in Raspberry. There'd have to be some indication
that
you have
a point well taken.
And the second is his suggestion that Mr. Smith could never file a habeas corpus petition because he's a sex offender in a California state prison. Well, the facts show that that's not true. But the logical extension of his argument is that there is no statute of limitations for California sex offenders.
Well,
that can't be true.
I think it's really clear under Evans that we're supposed to examine the reasonableness of the delay under the circumstances of each case.
I agree with that. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you very much,
Your Honor.
I know I used up too much time, but something was raised that was just raised in passing, and that's very important.
Well, I said you could have a minute.
Thank you.
Watch your clock.
The appealing, I was on that case by then, and I don't see how I could have appealed a dismissal without prejudice. And if I had made a mistake, then I'm calling myself as ineffective assistance. Because I was on the case then when it was dismissed without prejudice. And I don't see how a practitioner appeals a dismissal without prejudice.
You're right.
If I'm wrong on that, my bad.
You're right. You couldn't.
Okay. So what are we talking about? So that first, it's really important.
But you were given leave to amend.
Say that again?
You were given leave to amend by December 15, and that didn't happen either.
Oh, he was given an impossible task of exhausting all his state court cases in 2 months. Impossible.
But actually, he could have added his several exhausted claims, then he would have had a mixed petition, then he would have been subject, I think, to a different jurisprudence that would have provided more discretion under Ryan.
There were no exhausted claims.
His
appellate lawyer blew it big time, didn't federalize anything. The California courts were never apprised of that. But let me say one last thing. Raspberry says may is magic words, Your Honors. May means a judge has discretion. Judge Benitez said, I don't have discretion. When a judge thinks he has no discretion and Raspberry says you do, may then it has to go back.
All right. Thank you very much, Counsel. Smith v. Small is submitted.
Thank you.